Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Author Renee Rosen has penned five works of historical fiction. Her latest, Park Avenue Summer, focuses on two women, one fictional and one not. The setting is 1965, New York City, and the historical character that readers might recognize is Helen Gurley Brown. Through this novel, Rosen explores a four-month stretch soon after Brown was named editor-in-chief of a failing Cosmopolitan magazine. I recently caught up with Renee Rosen to visit about her latest book and about the progression of a Cosmo girl. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Park Avenue Summer focuses on two women primarily. One is fictional and one is not. The historical character readers might recognize is Helen Gurley Brown. And this novel covers a four-month stretch right after she's been hired and she's been named as editor-in-chief for a failing Cosmopolitan magazine. Why was her time at Cosmo so important?
You know, she inherited a magazine. I personally thought that Helen Gurley Brown had started Cosmopolitan, you know, but it goes back to the 1800s, and it was a literary magazine. You know, Mark Twain wrote for Cosmo, and Edith Wharton and Kipling and Pearl S. Buck. And, you know, Hearst kept sort of reinventing it throughout the decades, and subscriptions were starting to fail. By the time it reached post-World War II in the 50s and all, it was a suburban housewife magazine. So if you can imagine, you know, opening up Cosmopolitan today and seeing casserole recipes and how to clean your floor, they were actually going to fold it. When Helen took over with no magazine experience, no editing experience, she really opened a dialogue for women about their sexuality, about how to become more fulfilled. It was a magazine that just broke all barriers for women. And as a result, she changed the whole face of the industry, you know, from the cover to the contents. She started that. And now, you know, if you look back at like the first cover that she did, the woman's cleavage, like right out in front, that was so shocking. It's so tame by today's standards. But 1965, that was eye-popping stuff.
Did you discover anything about Helen Gurley Brown that would surprise readers?
I think how vulnerable she was. My impression of her was just this little petite woman who, you know, talked about sex the way other people talked about the weather. You know, there was so much more to her than that. She was notoriously cheap because she grew up so poor. She grew up in a trailer park. You know, she rode the bus to work every day. She took her lunch to work every day, and that was the days that she was eating because, of course, a splurge for Helen was an extra helping of diet gelatin. She was strong, but she was also incredibly vulnerable and open, selectively open, I should say. So if she was on this podcast with us right now, she would want everyone to know that she's wearing a wig and false eyelashes and that she had her nose fixed and that she was in psychoanalysis every week and that she'd slept with 166 men before she was married. She just liked to put it all out there. And I think she did that as a way to sort of level the playing field so that women wouldn't feel intimidated by her or competitive with her. She was a girl's girl, and she wanted people to be comfortable around her. Unless she wanted something from you, then she could manipulate the situation.
And now the fictional character in the book is Alice Weiss, who is Helen's secretary for those 4 months. And her character, her hopes and dreams, her family saga, they are covered in very nuanced detail. What should readers know about her?
I think she is that girl who leaves her small Midwestern town to chase a dream. And I think that is a theme that, going back to that movie, My Sister Eileen, I mean, there's nothing new about the girl leaving her small town to go to a big city. Anyone who has that dream, I think Alice kind of touches upon that and gives you someone to really root for. I mean, you root for Helen, but I think readers hopefully are also rooting for Alice to find her way, because she's just shell-shocked. You know, she arrives in New York City constantly getting lost and overwhelmed by the city, and the more she gets to know the city, the bigger it seems to become. And, you know, she's so proud of herself when she finally makes her way back to her apartment without getting lost. I know that I left Akron, Ohio, moved to Chicago, but then ultimately moved to New York and then back again. But I remember that feeling of just being so overwhelmed. You know, I wanted it. It was exciting, but it was also terrifying.
You know, I also like the way you kind of gave her a leg up a little bit, because, yes, she was moving from Ohio to New York City, but that was after her mother had moved from New York City to Ohio. And so when she was in New York City, I mean, she would run into her mother's best friend who was at a publishing house. And I did like that it wasn't just that cliched small town girl goes to New York. It was kind of going back to New York to fulfill her mother's dream in a way.
Right. So her mother, you know, was born and raised in New York City, meets her father, and ends up in Youngstown, Ohio, and she's a fish out of water there. And her mother's intention was always, I'm going to move my family back to New York. I want to raise my daughter in New York. And early on in the book, you learn that Alice's mother has died, and it was right when the family was about to move back to New York. And then her life starts to crumble in the years ahead, where her boyfriend basically leaves her at the altar. Her father has remarried, and Alice feels like there's nothing left for her in Youngstown, and she's going to go back to New York to not only chase her own dream, but fulfill a dream of her mother's, serve her mother's dying wish. She goes back there with a lot of, like, emotional baggage, I guess, or just an emotional obligation that she feels she needs to fulfill.
Now, both of these characters, you know, one fictional and one not, they're both really strong. So was perspective ever an issue for you, or did you always know that you would tell this from Allie's point of view?
You know, I had toyed around with the idea of telling it from Helen's point of view. It seemed like the obvious thing at first. But then when I started doing my research, there were a number of biographies about Helen Gurley Brown. There was also just a slew of books that Helen had written about herself, her own memoirs. And at that point, it's like, what can I bring to the story that's new? I don't want to just retell the story that we all know through a fictional Helen Gurley Brown. And that was when it's like, okay, if I bring in this young girl as the narrator, I can show the impact that Helen has on a young girl. Because Alice's whole world starts to open up. And not just her romantic conquests and her inner office, you know, affairs and all, just her view of the world and her confidence in herself to go after what she truly wants. And that was all a result of her being in such close contact with Helen Gurley Brown.
You know, you mentioned the books that Helen wrote, and much is made of Sex and the Single Girl. When she was at Cosmopolitan, that book came up and her views came up a lot. But she had a support system in place, didn't she? Talk to me about David Brown.
Yeah, so Helen Gurley Brown met David Brown when she was 35. And Helen always thought of herself as, she would teasingly say that she was a mouse burger. She reinvented herself physically, you know, with the wigs and the false eyelashes and all. But she met David Brown. He was a Hollywood producer. He had starlets all around him, and the mouse burger wanted to get him. And the book kind of goes into a little of her strategy of how she reined him in. But David was the one who said to her, after they were married 2 years later, you know, Helen, you were the most fascinating single woman I'd ever met. You should really write a book about what it was like. And that's where Sex and the Single Girl came from. And then when she took over the magazine, that was David who got her the job. Helen was terrified of taking on that position. And every time she came up against an obstacle, she would reach out to David. And, I don't want to give too much away, but they would have these nooners, what she called a nooner, where they would sort of tease out whatever the problem was with the magazine. And David was her silent partner. She had a private line put into her office that went straight to his. when Helen did have a lunch meeting, she would make sure that David was at the same restaurant and a nearby table just in case her meeting went south and he could swoop in and sort of save the day. He was her knight in shining armor, which is ironic because she was such a feminist, and yet she was very dependent on David.
On your website, this book is described as Mad Men meets The Devil Wears Prada. Are you a fan of both?
I loved Meryl Streep and The Devil Wears Prada. I just thought that was a fascinating portrayal of a thinly veiled Anna Wintour. And I loved Mad Men. You know, I was binge-watching Mad Men when I got the idea to write this book. So I think it was my editor that first said, oh, it's kind of like Mad Men meets Devil Wears Prada. And then I think it was a blogger that said, oh, it's like The Devil Wears Prada with Mad Men. And we're like, oh, we're just going with it.
Who is Lois Cahill?
She was my secret weapon when it came to research. So I was having lunch one day with a writer friend of mine and his wife, and he said, what's the new book about? And as soon as I said Helen Gurley Brown, they both like grabbed each other's hands and said, oh, we have to introduce her to Lois. And I'm like, who's Lois? And Lois regarded Helen as her second mother. Lois probably knew Helen Gurley Brown better than anyone else. She had met Helen Gurley Brown at Studio 54. Apparently, Lois was dancing with Chevy Chase, and she was introduced to Helen. She went back home. She had one of Helen's books on her bookshelf and started reading it, and it just really resonated with her. And she wrote, Dear Mrs. Brown, we met at Studio 54, and I just read your book, and it meant so much to me. And Helen wrote back and said, please come see me next time you're in New York. And it went from a correspondence like that, it went from Dear Mrs. Brown to Dear Helen to Dear Mommy Helen. And they just formed a very special friendship. And Lois moved back to New York, and every Sunday, Helen and David Brown would go have dinner at her house. You know, Helen gave her all kinds of advice about men, and some which was great advice and some which was typical Helen advice. And Lois was just so gracious. She vetted the book for me, and she would catch me when she said, you're starting to sound too much like Anna Wintour. That wasn't my Helen. And, you know, she shared so many things, little details about Helen, so that I was able to portray her more accurately.
Now, this is your fifth work of historical fiction, and you've written about prohibition, journalism, the civil rights movement, Chicago blues. What inspires you to write about these various subjects?
You know, it's interesting because it's very much a collaborative effort. It's me and my agent and my editor. I'll come up with a couple of ideas, and then we sort of tease it out. The blues book, for example, Windy City Blues, it started out just as a book about the blues. I had no idea that I was going to write about the civil rights movement or even Chess Records until I really got into the research. So the subjects definitely evolve from, you know, once we kind of get the general seed of what the idea is going to be, then as the writing process sort of starts happening, it takes on a life of its own. I'm like, yeah, this might not be exactly what you were expecting, but.
So you wrote this novel in the 21st century, and when you were writing about some of the social norms of the 50s and 60s, was anything, you know, like difficult to swallow?
Oh, certainly, like, you know, the way women were treated in the office and so marginalized, you know, that still goes on today, but thankfully to a lesser degree. That was kind of tough. And the restrictions put on women by society, you know, like Bridget, one of the secretaries at Cosmo in that time, she can't get birth control. Her doctor's like, I'm not going to let you ruin yourself. I mean, that was a sort of narrow-minded thinking. And that was frustrating that people would consider you to be just, you weren't a nice girl if you were out there having a relationship, even if it was with a partner that you loved. You know, you just weren't a good girl. So that was a little frustrating, but that was the way it was viewed.
We have talked about a lot, but is there anything that you want to talk about that I haven't asked?
You know, one of the things that's been really rewarding about this book, I had an older sister, and I grew up reading her Cosmos. So I knew Helen Gurley Brown. I didn't know as much about her, obviously, but I did know the name, and I was certainly familiar with the magazine. But what's been really gratifying is that there's been a whole slew of younger readers who maybe had never heard of Helen Gurley Brown. And, you know, they only know the Cosmo that they know today. So for them to say, you know, oh my God, she was such an inspiration and I had no idea, that's just been really gratifying to be able to sort of introduce a whole new generation to a woman who sort of paved the way for them to be who they are and the opportunities that they have today.
That was Renee Rosen, author of the book Park Avenue Summer, which was published by Berkeley. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.